have two women spacewalking at the same time. But nevertheless, it was a very successful spacewalk. Everything was completed, including get ahead parts of the mission that, you know, when they finish whatever they're doing, they always have get ahead programs. And they did send Christina Koch out to the end. Like I said, that's a little bit more risky, but she went all the way out to the end to get ready for next year when new batteries come up. They wanted to put in some handrails and things like that. So she was able to do that, and Nick Hague was able to do some other work inboard.
WH Royal Orbit question.
How you doing, Joe?
Yeah, go ahead. Hi, Paul. When these astronauts are going out on these spacewalks, I know they're tethered to wherever they leave from, where they have some sort of cord that lets them, you know, move, maneuver around, but keep them tethered to something so they don't tangle free. But are they still using these packs that they wear that have some sort of propulsion on to be able to let them turn around and go here and go there? And if anybody ever became untethered, hoping never, would they ever have enough fuel in these packs to be able to go after somebody within a, you know, a small reasonable distance away?
Yes, Joe, they have the regular spaces. If you were to see them putting this on in the Quest Lab is the module where they have the suits and put everything together, and then they eventually go through a door. It looks like a little garage door, and then they wind up in another section of the Quest Lab, and then they go out. Well, when they're putting their suits on, they have they put everything on, and it, you know, looks like they're almost ready. Then there's another pack that attaches to the backpack that they already have on, and that's one of the last pieces that they put on. It's called a SAFER pack. SAFER is an acronym, but it's essentially what you said. It's a jet pack. It's filled with nitrogen tanks, and they're able to maneuver. You know, if they got separated from the space station, they're able to maneuver, fly themselves back. And like you said, if somebody was unconscious for some reason, the other guy could detach from the space station, go out and get them and bring them back. Yeah, they do have that job.
Okay, very good. And how much maneuvering time do they get out of one of those type of packs?
They tested it on one of the earlier flights. The guys were out in the cargo bay of the space shuttle many years ago. And they were able to fly around quite a bit. And I remember them doing the testing. They were out there, I don't know, it seemed like a long time. They were playing around at least maybe half hour to an hour. Intermittently, you know, one guy would try it, and then the other guy would try it. And one guy actually untethered himself, and he flew around a little bit. These are different than the manned maneuvering units that you remember from, you know, even years before that in the 1980s. They used that about four different times. They were bigger units, and the same idea. They would have nitrogen in them, and they actually did leave the shuttle and, like, attach themselves to a satellite and eventually bring the satellite back into the bay. That was used around four different times. They called MMUs. They were called man maneuvering units. So they would go out in their spacesuits, and then they would attach themselves to the MMUs that were in the cargo bay, and then they would fly around. The safety units are different. They're compact. You know, it's more modern. It's part of the unit that, you know, when they go out through the Quest door, safety unit is already on. And to answer your other question, nobody's ever got separated from the space station. And they have these long tethers. They're on a reel. This WS2N. And then these reels have hooks on them. They attach them to different railings as they go along. And sometimes you can see it. You know, if you look at the picture, it looks like it's reeled out pretty far. I mean, one time it looked like it was around 30 feet. I don't know if it goes that far, but they have these reels, and they're able to go from one area to another.
they're always clipped on. They, you know, you can look through, you know, when they're doing a spacewalk, NASA's always looking through their helmets. They have helmet cams, and they can see their hands and working and everything. They're constantly hooking themselves onto these handrails, these gold-looking handrails. No matter what they're doing, they're always, you know, clicking on. When they move a little bit, you see them always unclicking and then clicking back on again. But, you know, before they unclick, they've already clicked onto another spot. So, and NASA watches this as the spacewalks are going on in case, you know, somebody, gets what they're doing temporarily. So that's the story on the space safety parts of it, anyway. Back to you, Joe. Okay, and I guess the pressure that comes out of those nozzles is preset at a certain low pressure to just give them, you know, enough of an oomph to be able to turn around, because I guess it doesn't take much energy to spin you around or get you going in a certain direction, seeing that you're, you know, you're all doing the same speed up there. It's just pressurized nozzles, you know. It goes toward down their back and up pretty high up around their neck. They, of course, can operate it. You know what I'm going to do, not now, but maybe later or tomorrow, I'll send over to Roy a picture of the safer unit. You know, it's different. It looks like a mini backpack, but it attaches to the actual spacesuit. Completely independent of the spacesuit, but it attaches to them before they go out the door. So, very good on that. So let me see. I was going to say there's one more spacewalk coming up, and that will be next week, I believe on the 8th. It's a Tuesday. I believe it's on the 1st, 7th, maybe a Monday. So they do have one more spacewalk, and that'll be, again, Anne McLean, and I believe, I think it's going to be Nick Hagan. I think it's going to be David St. Jacques, the Canadian astronaut. I believe he's going to be going out doing the spacewalk next time around. And they're going to do some work on top of these modules. I need to extend cables from Destiny, that's the American module, and out toward the front of the space station. They need to run a second set of cables. Really, it's going to be redundant cables for the power of the robotic arm. They need that out there in case, I guess, the one set goes bare, they'll have the other set. And then some data cables, and then also putting more cameras and some kind of antennas for Wi-Fi on the outside of the space station. So there is one more spacewalk coming up next week. And on the 2nd, that would be tomorrow, they're going to have a news conference, and they'll give you exact details on the spacewalk. It's interesting to watch these news conferences that when they talk about the spacewalk, they'll have animation. So if you bring up NASA TV, you'll see as they're describing things. They'll show the exact location of both astronauts as they're going out the door. Nice animation, the different locations on the truss, what they're doing, what they're bringing in, and then they tend to describe the acronyms that they use too. You know, they'll talk about the pistol grip tool, and they'll call the PGT, you know. You get an idea of the language in the next couple of spacewalks that you're watching, you start to pick up what they're saying. And then when you're actually watching the spacewalk, you know, you can hear the conversation, and you pick up on exactly what they're talking about. When you first watch it, it gets a little frustrating. But nowadays, sometimes you're watching and they'll have little descriptions that'll pop up on the screen talking about, you know, what this acronym means or what that acronym means. So, when they go out on these trusts, sections, you know. I mean, we think of the space station as this thing just flying around, but, you know, when you look at the close-up pictures of what they're doing, it's pretty incredible. They say it's like going on a, you know, 35-story building, going out for, like, the 15th floor window. And you go out, you look down, you look up, and that's the feeling these astronauts get as they're walking around on this thing. It's a massive structure, 330-some-odd feet long. It's like being on the side of a 30-story building, and they go from one end to the other, and they call it a spacewalk, but I mean most of the movement is done by hand, that's for sure. They hand over hand, getting from one location to another. So one interesting thing I found that during this last space flight, they had the astronauts go back to the old location where the last space flight was to relocate one of the batteries. Apparently, one of the lithium-ion batteries that was built by Japan and sent up and installed on the last spacewalk, one of the three is not working, not charging. And that kind of surprised me. You know, I just read it on one of the NASA sites, but they don't seem to be making a big deal out of it. I'd be in mad panic. You know, these things are really the heart of the system. You know, the solar panels are great, but solar panels are running everything. But they're also charging these batteries at nighttime. You know, the ISS is running off of, you know, strictly battery power. So what the deal is with that one battery, I don't know. I'm going to be anxious to find out what they find. You know, they have more of these batteries coming up, and then after the next delivery of batteries, you know, maybe 6 months or so from now, there's going to be another delivery. So these things better be working. Placing these nickel hydrogen batteries, which have been up there in some cases for you know, since 2002, really need to be replacing things with more reliable batteries. They claim they are same amount of amp hours for half the size and half the weight, and the recharge times I think are roughly 60,000 cycles. Sounds like a lot, but they recharge and charge 16 times a day. So I hope these lithium-ion batteries live up to their reputation. Let me drop it. Alright, let me go on to another topic anyway. Last week, the Electron rocket was launched from the North Island of New Zealand by a company called Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab is owned by this guy Peter Beck, one of these billionaire guys that got involved with building his own rocket, building his own launch complex in New Zealand. And now, presently, he's building another launch complex in the USA, right here in Virginia, in Wallops Island. So by the end of this year, he should have one launch from there. But, you know, it's roughly a 60 or 70 foot tall rocket. It's got nine engines, they call them Rutherford engines, so named it after Rutherford. His engines are running on liquid kerosene and liquid oxygen. And the reason they call the rocket the Electron rocket has nothing really to do with electrons, except the electrons are running these motors. He's got 950 horsepower motors, and he's got these batteries, lithium ion batteries, attached to these electric motors. The motors are spinning the turbines. In most rocketry, you have other ways of spinning the turbines. You know, they'll use the exhaust from the combustion, for instance. Or, you know, the Russians actually use steam. They convert hydrogen peroxide to steam, directly to steam. They run the turbines that way. But these things are run by electricity. And unfortunately, it's not a reusable rocket. So he's got nine of these engines on the first stage, and also one on the second stage, also an electric driven rocket. And this way, you don't have any loss. You're not taking the exhaust of something to run a turbine. You're not wasting that exhaust. So you're getting a lot more power out of the rocket itself by running the turbines with electricity. Therefore, he's able to make a smaller rocket. And this is, I think, his fourth launch from New Zealand since he started last year. And it was successful. This time he had a contract with DARPA. DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. So the United States got involved with this guy. And, you know, he's, by the way, these rockets are being produced and manufactured with 3D machines in California. So it's an American company, really. But he happens to be located in New Zealand. He himself is from New Zealand, this guy Peter Beck. But, you know, it was successful. I saw the launch. He's got cameras bouncing on the top of it. You know, when you're watching it, it really looks almost like a Falcon 9 going up, although Falcon 9 is like, you know, three times the size. But it almost looks like a SpaceX type of rocket. You know, it's got the 9 engines arranged in the same fashion that the Falcon 9 does. When it gets to orbit, he has a camera on board on the second stage. And you can see the second stage ignite, just very, very similar to looking at a Falcon 9 launch. You see Earth down below. And then he manufactures his third stage is called a Curie. He named it in a Mount Curie. So he actually produces his own third stage to put the spacecraft into orbit. So it was successful, and I'm sure he's happy about it. DARPA wanted to test out a new antenna. The antenna he sent up, it was in a box a little bit bigger than a CubeSat, maybe about three times bigger than a CubeSat, maybe about 10 inches in diameter, it looks like. And then when it got to orbit, it opens up. It's got this cape on. They call it cape on material. It's like a fabric. And the arms come shooting out of this very small package. And it opens up this cape on into almost an 8-foot diameter dish. It's 7.9 feet. But, you know, it's an 8-foot reflecting antenna. And they wanted to see if they could do this. You know, we're talking about people shooting missiles down earlier on Roy's portion of the net, you know, what India was doing. And, you know, sure, it's a possibility. So you could imagine all these countries decide to shoot satellites out of space that the military is using, you know, on a constant basis. One of the goals of the State Department and the, you know, the United States is to be able to put missiles up there real quick, satellites up there real quick in case that, you know, something happens, like getting one shot down, maybe even another satellite grabbing it, putting it into another orbit or something. You want to be able to have a quick exchange, be able to put up within a day another rocket with a satellite ready to go, and maybe in this case some kind of a nice beam antenna. So that was successful, and that's what you really need to do to have that capability. You know, if you're worried about, you know, some foreign country shooting our infrastructure down, this is another step to making sure that if they do, they'll be replaced. So the satellite was called R3D2. That was the name they gave to it. So if you want to see what it looks like, we put in R3D2 DARPA antenna, and you would be able to see exactly what I'm talking about. I didn't put it on Roy's
net. Maybe I should have, but I never got around to doing that today. On another note, China has a private company now. They're trying to do the same thing with a small rocket, trying to get it to orbit. The name of that company is called OneSpace. Well, OneSpace didn't make it. They got it up as it was going up. They lost control, and they have a film of this thing, you know, zigzagging as it's going. So apparently something went wrong. So that first attempt by a private company, commercial company in China, to put this 450-pound satellite in space did not work out. So, as far as light satellites are going, we're doing pretty good with it. We have a lot more things on the horizon coming up. Another launch to watch. Normally I read the next launches at the end of this segment of the net. But this one here is a Falcon Heavy, and it's going to be going up beginning of April. Got to look for the date somewhere. But it's another Falcon Heavy launch. Drop it. Right now they plan on putting an Arab satellite in, you know, the Arabs are paying SpaceX to put a Falcon Heavy, to use the Falcon Heavy rocket to get their Arab 6A communication satellite into orbit, geosynchronous orbit, and they're going to be launching it from Launch Complex 39A at Kennedy Space Center in Florida, you know, on board the KA man communication. But they're going to be using the Falcon Heavy rocket. If you didn't watch this thing last February 6th, that's the first time that SpaceX put the Heavy into orbit. You know, they launched the Falcon 9 Heavy. It was pretty good. I mean, it was interesting. You have three boosters strapped together, and they took off, and it was the first time he did it, so he was using a test piece. His test piece he put into orbit was a car. He put a Tesla car into orbit. Successfully did that. But the idea of SpaceX is to make space cheap, so to make everything reusable. Sure enough, that was the plan on these three boosters. The two boosters separated from the other core booster. And the core booster was supposed to land in the ocean on an autonomous ship, which he's done many times before. But this time it ran out of hydraulic fuel to operate it on the way down, and it wound up crashing in the water. But the two boosters, they came back successfully all the way back to Florida. He has a landing complex in Florida called Landing Zone 1. Essentially what he did is he took an old launch complex that we Cape Canaveral used to use, and it was Launch Complex 13, and he made a landing zone out of the two big concrete round structures in the middle of where the Launch Complex used to be. And if you watch the video, these two things coming back with the landing legs opening up and landing down, it was daytime. It was really something. It looked like it was almost animation. So he plans on doing that again, and he plans on saving the two boosters again. And with that, in a couple of months, he plans on launching a military satellite for us, for the U.S. From the same launch complex with reused boosters. So he is succeeding in bringing the cost of these expensive flights to orbit way down by reusing all this equipment. So that's the deal with that. Let me just see if there's anybody else with any comments or questions. This is WS2R. Okay. There's one telescope topic, actually two, that I had here. One is that they have, scientists have looked out and found a super planet 129 light years from here. And by using four telescopes, they linked them together. Some kind of visual interferometry. And I'm familiar with the interferometry of, you know, when you use radio telescopes. Well, this is somehow optically. It's optically done, and they're able to visualize this planet. It's a big planet, much bigger than Jupiter. But through this, all this information, I guess they're sending it through spectrometers or so, because they could tell that, you know, it's got methane, it's got all these different carbon monoxide, they could tell it has clouds, and I thought that was pretty interesting. Don't have a list of the different telescopes that we use, but there's one place, Paris, I believe. But, interesting that they could do that. The other topic I had was Neptune. I don't know if Roy would have had this on his list, but apparently Hubble has found dark spots on Neptune, different dark spots. Years ago, when Voyager 2 went past the outer planets, including Neptune, some scientists were very surprised to see a dark spot on Neptune. They knew about the giant red spot on Jupiter, but they didn't expect to see this on Neptune. But over time, that dark spot has dissipated. You know, they looked at Neptune many, many times, especially with Hubble. But now they can see recently that there's a new dark spot starting to develop on that planet. And they're using the Hubble Space Telescope. And the good news about that is that means the Hubble Space Telescope is up and running. If you listen to the net, they had problems in the last couple of months. Apparently, they've worked those problems out. And let's see. One other quick topic is the Mars helicopter that's actually going to be going to Mars. You have the Mars 2020 rover to be launched. 2020 actually will be landing in the beginning of 2021, January, what they call the Mars 2020 rover. Very similar Curiosity. It's got the RTG on there, you know, it's nuclear power. It's got the radioisotope thermoelectric generator, and it's about the same size, a little heavier than the Curiosity rover that's riding around up there now. But one of the things they're going to be bringing with it is this helicopter. The helicopter stands about 2.5 feet tall, and it's got these blades on it that are 4 feet in diameter, just shy of 4 feet, and two blades. They oppose each other in direction. One goes counterclockwise, the other one goes clockwise. Runs by electricity. It has a solar panel mounted on top of these two spinning blades, and they've been working on it for some time. I've seen models, and, you know, they've flown it around. But now they actually took the helicopter itself that will be going to, you know, the actual unit that will be going to Mars under the belly of the Mars 2020 rover, and they took it, put it into this 25-foot diameter location in a Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. Started up there, got little tethers on it, so the, you know, you can't get away from them. But they want to make sure it could go up a couple of inches, and that's all they needed to do. And succeeded, and there was a video on there, and I clicked on that. Sure enough, the thing was flying around for about a minute. So, and this is the actual unit, so now they're going to take it. They're actually going to mount it to the spacecraft, to the Mars rover. And they said the next time they turn this thing on, it's going to be flying on Mars. So they hope to get, like, at least five missions out of the, five flights out of this thing.
each time it will fly further and further every time they do it and we drop it. So there's no way to, like, you know, they don't fly. That means wherever this thing lands, it's probably going to go no further than the area that they're in. You know, first they're going to go like 300 feet away and then maybe another couple hundred feet away and then so on and so forth. But, you know, let's say the Mars rover gets to drive, you know, 5, 10, 20 miles eventually. It's not like the Mars rover can't go back and grab this thing and bring it with it and, you know, go somewhere else and then have it take off. That would have been cool. But unfortunately, they can't do that. But they do expect to get around 5 flights out of this helicopter. And that's pretty much it for the space portion of the TechNet. Any comments or questions? This is WS2N. Comment? I heard comments, but a little staticky, but try again.
Roger, this is Kilo 1 Mike Juliet Mike. I just wanted to mention that the Northeast Astronomy Forum is this coming weekend, Saturday and Sunday.
Oh, okay, Mike. Very good. And where is that? Is that the one in Rockland County?
Roger, Rockland Community College in Suffern, New York. Yep.
I know it's supposed to be very good, but I won't be going. But anybody that I've ever heard speak of it, I know Craig, he does the astronomy and he tries to get up there. I don't know if he makes it yearly, but he's described it a number of times on that net, and it's supposed to be very well worth it. Very good, Mike.
Take this, Kilo 1 Mike Juliet, Mike listening.
Yeah, I think the members of the Astronomical Society of Long Island, actually, quite a few of those members go, a good percentage of them. Mr. MJM, I think there are, what, about 50 or more vendors, maybe even 200 vendors of telescope materials, eyepieces, and things like that. Roughly how many vendors are there at Rockland Community College during this conference?
I'm going to guess say closer to 150 to 200. That's just a rough guess. It may even be more, but it pretty much fills that gymnasium.
And is it this coming weekend of the conference?
Roger, yes, this coming weekend, Saturday and Sunday.
Do you know the price of the ticket for both days? And the price of the ticket for one day?
Sorry, I should have looked that up before I got on the air, but I don't know offhand. I think it's around $15, I'm going to guess, $13, $15, something like that.
That sounds right. First time I went there, that's what I remember. And there's also a good number of lectures. I'll bet you there's about 15 lectures on astrophotography and things like that. Isn't that true?
Roger, they have keynote speakers. I think they have a couple astronauts that keynote speakers Saturday and Sunday. And then they have various smaller lectures in classrooms.
What's the name of the club that you're a member of?
I'm a member of the Westport Astronomical Society.
Roughly how many members are there in that particular society?
We have about 150.
Wow. Do you guys hold your meetings once every month?
We have a board meeting every month, and then we hold lectures open to the public once a month also. They're all posted on our website.
The Astley Group on Long Island has a meeting almost every single week. That amazes me.
Roger, we have public nights every Wednesday is a public night where we open up our telescopes to the public. We have a 16-inch telescope in our dome, and we have a 25-inch mirror telescope that we can't fit in the dome, so that's on the ground, and a bunch of smaller telescopes, 10, 12-inch telescopes. So that's every Wednesday, weather permitting, and then whenever there's a special event like the Messier Marathon or, you know, something with the transit of Mercury with the sun, something like that, we have solar scopes too. So we're open to the public for special events too.
And that's held in what town in Connecticut?
across Westport, Connecticut. It's pretty much right across the Long Island Sound somewhere from where you are.
Westport, Connecticut. Beautiful. Wow. And so solar observing, both red filter as well as white filter observing. And you said a 16 inch and a 25 inch. You guys have a 25 inch Kazakh rain. Amazing.
25 inch Newtonian is not a Kazakh rain. It's just a regular Newtonian. Yes, it's called an obsession. And our solar scopes, they're special solar scopes. They're hydrogen alpha scopes. One for month, one for Coronado, with the, they call double stack. You adjust the light frequency, the, using pressurized gas.
Yeah, I've seen those, double stack type ones. They have an extremely narrow test band, which allows you to really see the fine details of what's going on with the sun's Doppler, the portions of the sun's speckles that are moving toward you and away from you. Back to you, KQLIW.
Roger, the first time I looked through one, I was absolutely amazed to see the granularity on the surface, and you could, tune to see different, like, depths of the granularity and the solar flares and the sunspots. You could, tune it to see all of the different phenomena on the surface of the sun and around the sun, yes.
Now, in order to see a prominence around the perimeter of the sun, you have to put some kind of a blocking object to make it a, I can't think of the name of it now. You have to put a blocking device to block away the center of the sun in order to see the prominences on the edge. What's the name of that opaque object? And when you do that, what do you call the whole thing? There's a name for it that I can't think of right now. Go ahead.
Dick, sorry, it's a little bit beyond me. I know we can tune the telescope without making it look like an eclipse. We can tune the telescope to see the prominence without having to block the sun. It does help, but definitely with the hydrogen alpha double stack filter, we can definitely see the prominence without that eclipse effect.
I think it's a coronagraph, Dick.
That's the word I'm looking for, coronagraph. So because of the way you can tune the double stack, you can literally see the snakes in the center and the prominences on the perimeter simultaneously. Is that true?
I believe that depends on how bright the prominence is, but yes, at many times, yes, you can see both at the same time. Yep.
I bet you've done a fair amount of astrophotography using that double stack. Is that true?
Roger, we have a little group that specializes in the solar photography. Again, if you go to the website, you can see some of our pictures of, the sun and the prominences. Like I said, it's a little group that specializes in the solar photography.
Okay, I've run out of questions. And have you really run out of material, Paul? That's not like you. WS2N, K2RW.
I'll throw a question in there. I still have a list. I could always tell you about the I guess seven important launches coming up, but I'll let Joe go. One important one I really want to talk about. What planet or star would be visible at about 240 degrees? I took my transit out a little while ago, about an hour ago, and I was looking up to the about 240 degrees up in the sky. And this thing looked like it's a multicolored type of star. I wasn't sure what it looked like, a planet or a star. Everything else looked to be like just twinkling, but this thing had multicolors on it. And I seemed looking at it through a pair of binoculars. Yeah, that's due west, though. I would imagine it's way too late to be Venus. It's usually sunset, so we know that it's not that. Don't know yet. Wow. I bet Mike would know. But I don't know. Anybody know what's up there at this time at 240 degrees? And what's the elevation? What are we looking at? 20 degrees? 45 degrees? Joe?
I'd say about 30, 35 degrees up. Someone's around 30, 35 up.
Mike, any chance that he's looking at Jupiter in that direction?
Dick, hate to tell you, but we've had such bad weather lately, I really haven't been paying attention.
And to be at 240 degrees, which is, let me think, that's the opposite of being in conjunction. That means the Jupiter would be on the other side of the sun from us, and going to be a little bit less bright. Could you see any apparent diameter, or did it look like a point source, Joe? Go ahead.
Seemed to look like a point source of light, multicolored. If I actually took binoculars and defocused them slightly, you could seem to identify the colors a little more easily than it was when it was focused sharp on the object itself. But it looked almost like a pinpoint of light.
Yeah, if it was a planet, they tend not to twinkle. Only the stars twinkle. And the reason for that, let's see if Paul can tell us. How come the stars twinkle and the planets do not, though, Paul?
Yeah, now we're talking about the scintillation of the atmosphere. And you're gonna see that with that. With the planets, you're gonna have a much more, magnitude? It's gonna be a lower magnitude, lower number, brighter it is. And anything with depth, planets have an angular distance. That's going to get through. That's not going to be affected by it. It's in thin air. So your planet's going to make it through the atmosphere, and the star is going to be affected by the quite a little waves in the air. Back to there.
Yeah, the stars are so small in apparent diameter that they represent a truly planar wavefront approaching you. And when that truly planar wavefront goes through any atmospheric, you know, inhomogeneity, portions of it get delayed a little bit more than others. Therefore, you get this twinkling effect, somewhat like, it's a little bit similar to the twinkling effect you get from a laser pointer in the dark when flashed against a rough surface like the wall. Somewhat similar effect. A planet has got a much broader apparent diameter. And although portions are being in phase and out of phase, delayed by the atmospheric inhomogeneity, still a null of one portion of the planet will give you a peak of another portion of the planet because there's some apparent diameter. That's my way of looking at it. I might be wrong. Let's see what Mike's got to say. Mr. MJM, K2LIW.
That's okay. You might be listening. Dick, I just want to let you know about the Indian space vehicle that's going to be going up. So this one doesn't have to do with shooting things down, but they plan on going to the moon in this April. We have about three different cargo vehicles going up to the space station in April. So there's a lot of launches. There's another one, another launch by the Pegasus vehicle that will launch the Icon satellite to study the ionosphere. But the interesting one that India is doing, they're going to send a they're going to use the geosynchronous satellite launch vehicle. That's their big vehicle to launch a vehicle to the moon. It's got an orbiter. And this one has a lander, and after it lands, it's got a rover. So India's going to be doing the same thing that China has done twice since 2013, and that's pretty much it. Back to you, Dick, WSLM.
The Americans call them astronauts. The Soviet Union, or the former Soviet Union, call them cosmonauts. What do the Chinese call their space people? And what do the Indian people call their space people, Paul?
China, they're called takanauts. Start with the letter T, takanauts. India, the only thing I've ever read is astronauts, so not sure. But it's always interesting to watch their launches. You know, you could watch their launches, and they have one guy speaking American, another guy speaking in their language, Sanskrit, whatever it is, and then the same type of thing. You see different languages in French Guiana when they launched the vehicles down there to the European Space Agency. You know, the countdown is in French. But I'm not sure what the name for astronaut is in Indian.
We have how many astronauts / cosmonauts on the International Space Station right now? I think it's six lives up there, Paul.
Yes, six people on board. We have two women from the U.S., one man also from the U.S., Nick Haig. Two women are Ann McLean and Christina Koch. Then you have a representative from the European Space Agency, which is the Canadian astronaut David St. Jacques. He's from Canada, speaks French. And then you have two Russians, each Russian pilot, each Soyuz, if they needed to get back. You need two commanders to command those things. So you have two Russians. Total of six people.
And you're almost out of time. So as your final comment, how many of them do you believe have a ham radio license, Paul?
We're running out of time. I'm going to give you the call letters. But the two women and Nick Haig and the Canadian are all hams, and then the Russians I think have at least one over there. Back to you.
Okay, you better tie the ribbons on it and tell us whether or not you think we should be looking at one of the launches this week.
Okay, yeah. Well, the next important launch is on the. To me anyways, the Progress ship, Soyuz, on the 4th, and then another launch, French Guiana, another Soyuz vehicle, but, you know, it's by European Space Agency in South America. And then followed after that, the main one, I hope this one gets off the ground, is going to be April 7th. You have the SpaceX Falcon Heavy. That's the one that will make the news. You'll see those things coming back to Earth again. And hopefully the other one landing on the ship. They missed last time. Back to you there.
Okay, we're essentially out of time. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Roy. Thank you, you listeners and participants. This was the TechNet, K2RIW, clear for now. See you guys next week.
RIW, RYY. Did you make use of the email I sent you last week?
Did I make use of the blank that you sent me last week, which I guess was an email? And I probably haven't yet, Joe Barrett.
Okay. Well, it'll answer your question you were sort of puzzled about last week, so read the last incoming email from me. Have a good night.
Just to make sure I got it, tell me the subject matter.
It has to do with radios.
Old radios, new radios? Give me another hint. What about radios, did it say?
I have to open up my computer and look at the exact heading I put in for the subject line, but it had to do with radios. Specifically, the radio system you're talking on. Those kind of radios.
Now I remember. Thank you. Bye-bye for now.
Good night. I'll be 2-1.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater. Thank you. 7:30. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. System. tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System.